Shalom Aleichem, welcome to the Schmooze, the Yiddish Book Center's podcast. I'm Lisa Newman, and today I'm visiting with Ross Perlin. Ross is a linguist, writer, and translator focused on exploring and supporting linguistic diversity. His book, Language City, The Fight to Preserve Endangered Mother Tongues in New York, is just out from Grove Press. Since 2013, he has been co-director of the Endangered Language Alliance, managing research projects on mapmaking, documentation policy, and public programming for urban linguistic diversity. He also teaches linguistics at Columbia. His writing has appeared in the New York Times, The Guardian, Harper's, and elsewhere, and his first book, Intern Nation, How to Earn Nothing and Learn Little in the Brave New Economy, ignited a national conversation about unpaid work. He is also a Yiddish Book Center Translation Fellow alum. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me, Lisa.
Great to have you here, and really lovely to have made the introduction to the book. It's wonderful. So to get started, I wondered if you'd share a little bit about the Language Alliance, your work, and as you write about New York, the most linguistically diverse city in the history of the world.
Sure. I'm trained as a linguist, and actually my PhD and my work actually was on languages of Highland Asia, so the Eastern Himalaya, Southwest China, where I spent a number of years doing documentation, what we call language documentation on an endangered language. So that's a subfield of linguistics that I've been in for some time. I came back to New York, my hometown, after that, and joined the Endangered Language Alliance, which took a new approach to the documentation of endangered languages, to this kind of this global language crisis, where more than half of the world's 7,000 plus languages are set to no longer be used, perhaps within the next few centuries. And the realization was that, a lot of the work of documenting and preserving endangered languages could be done in cities that are newly hyper diverse, that have always perhaps been diverse to some degree, but a place like New York has become really the most linguistically diverse city in the history of the world, as far as we can tell. And we have been working on that and sort of documenting that as an organization, a collection of linguists, language activists, speakers, ordinary New Yorkers for more than a decade. So this new book, Language City, is a record of that. It's the story of the Endangered Language Alliance as this very strange organization that's doing this. And it's the linguistic history of New York, which is extraordinary, going back to its indigenous language, Lenape, and among other things, the great center of Jewish languages as well, which has been one of our projects that I started and have a strong interest in as a sort of Kumoy Yiddishist, a somewhat wannabe Yiddishist who has learned the language both from family and from places like the Yiddish Book Center over the years. But also I've worked as a linguist on other Jewish languages as well, such as not just Ladino, Judeo-Spanish, but also Juhuri, the language of the so-called mountain Jews of Azerbaijan and Dagestan, Bukhari, the language of the Bukharian Jews, various forms of Jewish Neo-Aramaic, and so on. So all of this is in the book. And then there's also a focus on the stories of six speakers of endangered languages from different parts of the world who are in various ways working on behalf of their languages in different parts of New York. And one of those chapters is on Yiddish, or we could say Bessarabian Yiddish, which is the language of Boris Sandler, who I profile, the former editor of Fulverts and a great Yiddish novelist, originally from Moldova, now in Brooklyn. So I hope that there are many things in this book, and that listeners of to the Shmooze especially will find a lot on Jewish languages, on Yiddish there.
Yeah, the chapter on Boris is really wonderful. Let's just talk briefly for a second, because I think the idea of endangered languages is something that maybe all of us don't have enough of an awareness of. I mean, I think people come to the center sometimes and think of Yiddish and it becoming an endangered language. But again, you map out a large story. Can you tell me sort of like at the extremes what some of these languages are facing in terms of living speakers? And also maybe, what is, if possible, the most endangered? Is there a language, as you note in the book, that, has very few speakers left?
The situation of Yiddish is a complicated one, and it often comes up in these situations. Oh, is Yiddish endangered? What does that mean? And it's kind of a mini controversy that people like to debate about. And in a sense, now it can be said, and many are saying that Yiddish is not endangered. There are different ways of looking at it. Obviously, places like the Yiddish Book Center are safeguarding the literature and a lot of what can be the sort of literary culture. At the same time, Hasidic communities are maintaining Yiddish or their varieties of Yiddish as a daily spoken language. Certainly, varieties of Yiddish very much are, but it's true that actually there are many, many languages that are much more clearly and unequivocally endangered than Yiddish is, including most Jewish languages. But broadly speaking, there are in fact scores of languages which have really just one speaker left, as far as is known. That is actually a common occurrence. And more than half of the world's languages have fewer than 10,000 speakers, from what we know, numbers-wise. And those with just one known native speaker include Lenape, the indigenous language of New York, which I profile as well, of New York City and the surrounding area. And I met the woman in her 80s, Diane Snake, in Southwest Ontario, who is kind of universally agreed to be the last native speaker. There are a number of people courageously revitalizing the language as second language speakers. That includes Karen, the teacher of the language, who has been bringing it back to New York until she passed away, and was doing that at our office at the Endangered Language Alliance. So there's a chapter kind of focused on her. But it's very common for now there to be one or just a few speakers of any given language. That's how far advanced this is, especially in terms of Native American languages, Australian languages, certain parts of the world in particular. And then many of the languages we're talking about, by virtue of being primarily oral and having not been noticed or documented at all, they're endangered also in the sense of having no documentation, of not really having any dictionary, grammar, any linguistic materials about them. And that's really been the focus of a lot of our work and of this field of language documentation.
I'm going to ask you a little bit about the methodology in a minute, but I wanted to pick up on a quote which really resonated with me in your introduction, which is, "But most linguists study language with a capital L, not languages. Every one of us has a linguistic history, however buried or unexamined." I think that's such a profound statement in a way, because I don't know. I know personally, I don't think about this. I don't know that many of us think about that history. And I wondered if you could expand on that idea.
Sure. Yeah, there are a number of elements to it, I think. In terms of linguists and linguistics, I think there has been, perhaps too much of a focus on linguistic theory, which is kind of what I mean there by capital L language, or the idea that there's really kind of one universal language, or there's, a set of universals that we can just find in every language, and that, we can actually just even look at English, and then we'll, by extracting so-called universals from English or Spanish or a few larger languages, we'll sort of know what there is to know about human language. And that's kind of associated with the so-called Chomskyan revolution in linguistics. And there was a lot of optimism about that in the 1950s and 60s, that we would find these universals and that all human language would really sort of look the same in the end. But that's really not been borne out by the findings of linguists working all over the world. Actually, linguistic diversity goes deep. Of course, there are certain things one can say at a broad level, but really the fascination is in, all the this is sort of the different modes of expression and the different ways of doing things linguistically. And that's what's sort of come out more and more over recent decades, and really realizing that just at the moment when that diversity is slipping away and when it's so poorly documented. So in terms of linguistics, I'd like to think that our work is part of a sea change. Where linguistic diversity is much more in focus, and the documentation of, actually existing languages, of which, one with one speaker somewhere may tell us as much about the nature of human communication as English or Mandarin. In terms of our linguistic backgrounds that everyone has, I think that's also something kind of unexamined for many people. who may at this point be monolingual English speakers. If we think of, most American Jews at this point, I mean, I was raised as a monolingual English speaker, essentially, in a, kind of third, fourth generation American Jewish family. And that the degree of amnesia really about even about Yiddish or I mentioned my great grandmother who was highly multilingual as so many immigrants were and are speaking four or five languages in the course of a single day that's so easily sort of forgotten. And most of us, I think, if you just scratch the surface a little bit, actually have connections to a wide range of languages in our family and cultural histories. And that includes not only kind of these well-known large national languages, but languages which have been primarily oral, minority languages, and have not really received much support from any kind of official source.
It's really great work that you're doing, honestly, and fascinating. And I guess I do want to ask you, is there a methodology to how you work with these endangered languages to preserve them, to understand them?
I hope that it comes out in the book. I spent some time discussing this in, the various chapters about our work with some of these six different speakers. And it varies by language, it varies by situation. As an organization, the Endangered Language Alliance is kind of we're open to the things that people bring to us and the projects they want to do. That could be, publishing children's books, that could be oral history videos, it could be some electronic resource. And it looks very different, generally speaking, from, say, the important work of the Yiddish Book Center, which I think, our work rhymes with in a sense, but there, there was a massive literature, there were books that could be saved. We're often talking about languages that for which there are no books, where our work may lead to the production of the first book. So in terms of the field that I sort of was trained in and maybe the original core of our work, which, is involved with linguistics and this field of language documentation, and I describe it in the book. It's really the nitty-gritty of lexicography, creating a dictionary with speakers, writing a grammatical description, figuring out the grammar. How do you, how does the sound system work? There's something called minimal pairs where you have to sort of, find words that differ only in one segment, and that way you can tell what's a meaningful sound, which linguists call a phoneme. How do you ferret out the syntax? How do you kind of understand the semantics? And then producing, especially this kind of triad, as it's often considered, of a dictionary, a grammar, and a corpus of texts, good, high quality archive ready recordings with full metadata, so that they can be maximally kind of used and preserved. That show the language in action. And for each of those pieces, there's a whole set of practices. How do you create that kind of corpus? How do you, the software that you use? What is good dictionary making? What is good practice? So there's a whole kind of field around this that has been growing and that I hope to kind of provide some insight into in the book.
You tell it well, and I wonder if you might talk a little bit about maybe what are some of the challenges in the context of one or two of the people and their languages that are profiled in the book.
Yeah, sure. I'd love to give some examples. I certainly think the section on Boris will be fascinating to listeners because here's somebody who's really trying in so many ways to be a sort of infrastructure for Yiddish literature and has been through so many contexts. Being born in Moldova, then kind of having studied in the Soviet Union, having moved to Israel and been involved with Yiddish there, and then coming to New York to edit the Fovrets in its kind of a last kind of gasp of its work in terms of Yiddish, and trying to bring it into the digital age as well, and his novels and things that he started. So his career I think encapsulates so much of the story of post-war Yiddish, and I hope it's fascinating to people on that level. And he was in that one of the last generations in post-war Moldova to be raised in Yiddish, one of the last real groups of people in terms of a non-Hasidic community. In terms of some of the others, the first of the six portraits is of a language called Seke, which I've been working on really intensively with a community that's roughly divided between five villages of Nepal and Brooklyn and Queens, and where, over 100 of the speakers have really come to a single building, a kind of vertical village in Brooklyn. And I've been working with one of the youngest speakers on really primary documentation, where we're really sort of partnering and doing field work both in Nepal and here in New York, and kind of, building up the basics of a language that has essentially nothing really, and fewer than 700 speakers, and now really no young speakers under 25. To give a few other examples, I talk about Ibrahima, who is an activist for a writing system called Nko from West Africa. He's from Guinea, but came to New York over 3 decades ago. And this is a relatively new writing system. It turns out West Africa has been a hotbed of new writing systems that, in a sense, are kind of proving that African languages can be written, and that they can sort of actually, be better writing systems than any of the colonial alternatives that have been brought to bear. So this writing system actually marks the tones and features of the relevant languages, which are from a group called the Manding languages, very well from a linguistic point of view. And he's been tirelessly kind of teaching and promoting this writing system as a way to unite speakers of these languages and give them a way to write and publish, and especially do things online in the digital realm, growing West African world, especially in Harlem and the Bronx.
The stories are really fascinating and they're all very different. I wonder how you find your way to some of these people and what their reaction is to your interest in working with them or learning about their language.
For most of the stories, the place of intersection is the Endangered Language Alliance, and it really has been enabled by the organization, which, as I say, I've co-directed since 2013. But there's, hundreds of people, if not thousands of people, have sort of passed through it. When we operate on a shoestring, funding is always an issue. Where, it's a lot of kind of volunteering and just like love of language. We have people, calling us, emailing us all the time. A lot of people have come to us in various ways, or it works through various levels of word of mouth and connection. We, as part of this, I describe in the book, we did a really sort of first ever kind of language mapping project, which you can see the results of at languagemap.nyc. There's also a print map, which you can donate for. It kind of supports all of this work, but it's really the first time that the full kind of linguistic picture of any city has been mapped, 5 times the number of languages that the census shows. Again, we felt that for, again, New York is not unique in this respect. We really could talk about LA and London and Boston and any number of places. It just become more and more linguistically diverse, including many indigenous, minority, and endangered languages. But New York presents, I think, a special opportunity. And obviously, we sort of formed around that. So the language mapping project also brought us into contact with so many people. For Boris and Yiddish, that was a bit of a separate track because of my involvement with Yiddish institutions, especially in New York. Boris had kind of commissioned me when I was living in China, actually, to do videos in Yiddish of my work and life there and with different Jewish communities that I was meeting. I was involved a little bit with the Volksbühne. I was involved with the Yiddish Book Center. I had sort of that was connections with Boris and the Yiddish world. But in other cases, it was kind of that long-term organic work of the Endangered Language Alliance that kind of, we approached people approached us, and in some cases there's shock and disbelief that anybody would be interested in their languages, because people are so used to just the sort of ignorance or indifference of outsiders. But by and large, what we've found is that there are a lot of people in New York and elsewhere who are working on behalf of their languages. In some ways, it's a golden age of language revitalization that's happening despite the high levels of endangerment, or maybe because of it. And what's really needed is support from majority language speakers, whether it's linguists providing our sort of technical knowledge, or funding as well is desperately needed. But there was a great openness by and large to me telling these stories. But the relationships were built up over years of trust and partnership, not a sort of traditional journalistic kind of just a moment of contact.
And it's interesting how much can be gleaned from understanding that footprint, as it were, of a language. I mean, again, Boris's story tells a much larger story. And I loved the mention of, how you could be walking down a sidewalk in New York and how many languages you might be able to pick up from passing conversation.
I hope that's one of the things that people really sort of feel and take out of the book. It gives them a new way to see New York, to see any city, to see their neighbors. Endangered languages are not on distant mountains or islands. They're now right next door. They're somewhere right away. I think that's, I mentioned, I think there's communities I mentioned that are in Western Massachusetts, that are in New England. There are really, I think, things that are just out of earshot or might not be visible to us, but I hope to have brought them closer through the book and shown that linguistic diversity is kind of all around us, even if we don't know what people are speaking. Hopefully, it's a bit of a guide to that. Hopefully, it's a new way to experience cities.
I mean, I think in the same way, sometimes we're encouraged to open up to looking at nature, if I may. You've encouraged me in reading your book to listen in a different way. So for that, I thank you. And I wonder, if, as a last question, if you could have imagined that you'd end up working on all of this to preserve endangered mother tongues and to tell the story and to do the mapping and all the other associated work.
It would be hard to imagine for who I was growing up as a kid. On the one hand, I was, I was fascinated by languages. I loved languages. I was, although raised as a monolingual English speaker, there were Yiddish words especially, and knowing that my grandparents had spoken this other language and that there were contacts with still other languages, and that, I knew that there this was around me, but I didn't really have access to it, and I just only was beginning to understand, my limits as a monolingual English speaker at that time. So, gradually, whenever I had the opportunity to dip into another language, I tried to do that. But I think, it took a long time for me to understand. It took going 7,000 miles away for my, doctoral research and doing field work in a distant village. And really encounters with people who have just a totally different background from me, for me to actually sort of look back in upon myself, my family, to look at Jewish languages in a different way, to look at Yiddish, to look at New York, my home, with this kind of lens. So I think, I hope that this is part of a I think also, it can be a very Jewish kind of approach to looking at diversity and diaspora and linguistic multiplicity, and trying to sort of hear all that, and channel it for something greater.
Again, for our listeners, the book is Language City, The Fight to Preserve Endangered Mother Tongues in New York. It's available at bookstores and online at shop.yiddishbookcenter.org. Ross, thank you for your work and for telling this story.
Thank you so much, Lisa. Shalom, dank.
You have been listening to The Schmooze, a production of the Yiddish Book Center in Amherst, Massachusetts. To learn more about this podcast and to subscribe, visit yiddishbookcenter.org. I'm Elizabeth Carteropoli. Until next time, be well and be healthy.